This is Gary Parrish again from CBS Sports. It's now Monday, November 16th, and this is the Eye on College Basketball podcast. I'm joined today, as usual, by Sam Vecenie, but no Matt Norlander. You might remember, if you listened to last Wednesday's podcast, we were joking. We ended up talking about babies, like, for about 40 minutes. I apologize if you wanted to hear basketball talk. But the reason was because Norlander was expecting his first child. And by expecting, I mean, wasn't supposed to come for at least a couple more weeks, I believe. But he's at the hospital right now. It's Monday morning, and he and his wife went to the hospital Sunday night. So there's a decent chance by the time you're listening to this, Matt Norlander will be a father. There's a 100% chance either way he's not going to be involved. So it's just Sam and I, and I appreciate you being here. And listen, we've got now, I guess, 3 days of games underneath us. Started Friday night, then all day Saturday and Sunday. Just your, in general, takeaway from the weekend. 3 days into the college basketball season, what stands out to you?
Yeah, I'd say it was kind of weird that we got all of those upsets.
Yeah.
Like last year, you know, Mississippi lost on opening night. I think Missouri lost on opening night last year as well. But this year it was crazy. We had UCLA losing. We had Georgetown lose Saturday morning. We had a bunch of teams that have legitimate NCAA, like, tournament hopes go down. And that was very, very surprising to me, at least. They lost to some teams that are pretty good mid-majors, like Monmouth's a pretty legitimate mid-major against UCLA. Chattanooga might win the SoCon this year against Georgia. But having said that, these are still schools that high major teams with NCAA tournament at large aspirations shouldn't be losing to.
No. And I mean, I think the biggest one, and I don't know that Virginia Tech falls into the category of NCAA tournament aspirations, but like you don't lose to a SWAC school if you're an ACC school, like, period, end of story, right?
And so, like the SWAC, I think, has been the worst rated conference in Ken Pom's like conference rankings for the last decade,
right?
It, like, last year they had one team ranked inside the top like 220 in the country. It was like, that's an unforgivable loss if you're Virginia Tech and Buzz Williams, who, again, that team actually has a decent amount of talent. Like, Jalen Hudson's a sneaky NBA guy. They have a couple good freshmen there. Like, there's no circumstance where you should be losing that game.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously didn't see the game, but like I saw the score, and I just I don't understand how something like that happens. And I trust it's driving Buzz insane over the subsequent days. I was up in Annapolis for the Veterans Classic. Just a wonderful couple of days. I got to spend a lot of Thursday with Roy Williams, the North Carolina coach. And then, of course, on Friday night, they opened up without Marcus Paige. And one of the things we had talked about a lot last year, in fact, I remember you did a blog post on it about what were the problems with North Carolina's offense. What were the problems specifically with Marcus Paige last year? And one of them was that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is the point you made, like, they had no shooters anywhere else in the court. And
yeah, couldn't space the floor.
Couldn't space the floor. And so, like, Marcus Paige had nowhere to go beyond the fact that he was also, like, banged up all year long. But the reason North Carolina, I say struggled, but it's only struggled relatively. Like, they still ended up being a Sweet 16 team. But the reason they weren't, at least early on, what most people projected them to be was because they could not shoot the ball at all. And, mm-hmm. and in fact, as the season went on and you look at the final stats, I think they shot around 34% from 3-point range. It ranked 99th in the country. Marcus Paige was the only person who is still in the program who averaged even more than one made 3-pointer per game. And yet, they made 7 Friday night. In a season-opening victory against Temple. They made 8 yesterday in a blowout of Fairfield. Now, yesterday they didn't shoot it well. Like, the percentage wasn't great. But as of this moment, they've made 15 three-pointers through 2 games. They're shooting 43% from three-point range through 2 games. And they're doing this without Marcus Paige. Is that a good sign?
Yeah, definitely. Last year, you know, it wasn't necessarily even the percentage of time that they were making that 3-point shot. The problem was that they weren't even taking them.
Right.
They finished second to last out of 351 teams in the country in 3-point attempt percentage, which is basically what percentage of your shots are 3-point attempts. They finished second to last in that statistic last year, which means teams were just basically closing down the paint on them, and they still weren't taking advantage of that by shooting the 3-pointer to try and get them to come out of the paint and free up that space for Kennedy Meeks and Bryce Johnson. But yeah, this is definitely a encouraging sign, I would say. I don't necessarily know that I would make conclusions off of it,
right,
but it's encouraging that without Marcus Page, who, like you said, is their best three-point shooter, that they're starting to knock down some shots. I mean, Joel Berry was a guy that shot an intriguingly decent percentage last year. I think he was right around like 35-36%. He made 5 three-pointers this weekend. Nate Britt made 7 three-pointers this weekend. So if those guys can come along and continue to shoot the ball well from the outside, that would be a really big boon for them. But having said that, I still have my concerns a little bit, because both Barry, all of these guys that are making the threes are very much bit players. Like, I want to say that nobody else in North Carolina's rotation took a three outside of Theo Pinson, Nate Britt, and Joel Berry.
Right.
And you figure that at least one of those guys is going to come off the floor whenever Marcus Page comes back. And again, you kind of have to assume there's going to be some sort of regression. So I'm optimistic, but I'm not necessarily going to sit here and say, it's fixed, it's fixed.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure it's fixed. It's just, like you said, encouraging through two games. Justin Jackson, Marcus, I spent some time with Marcus on Thursday as well, and he told me that Justin had been making shots in the preseason. Mm-hmm. Now, he was terrible Friday night. Like, I mean, and I don't mean like terrible shooting, but he was just terrible in general. Like, he did nothing. He did nothing. Now, he's obviously talented, but he didn't do anything for them. But you make a good point. When you talk to coaches, and I've had this conversation over and over because of where I live. You know, the Memphis Grizzlies are here, and the issue isn't that they're a bad 3-point shooting team. I mean, that's an obvious issue, but the issue in addition to that is that they don't take them. And you talk to people in basketball, making them's great. Taking them is also important, just to, mm-hmm. just for floor spacing. And so, as I'm sort of talking off the top of my head here, you know, the Grizzlies play a more traditional lineup with two bigs, and they don't really, you know, they don't have a stretch four, and they don't shoot the basketball from the perimeter. North Carolina also plays a more traditional lineup with, you know, they're big up front. They don't shoot the three-pointer. And with the way basketball's going, obviously you can still win that way. They're ranked number one in the country. Mm-hmm. But it's not the way basketball's typically played in the year 2015.
Well, the thing is, like, even in the NBA, I feel like you can get away a little bit more with playing two traditional posts that can't really shoot if you also have another guy like Tony Allen, for instance, that can't shoot from the outside. The floor is spaced out just a little bit more because of the increased distance back with the three-point line, that you can find some little creaks and crevices in the mid-range game to where it'll work. In college, because the three-point line is so much closer, it's much harder to find that space inside the three-point line. So you really need to have, if you're going to have two traditional posts, you really need to have three guys on the floor who can space the three-point line and actually knock down shots and feel comfortable taking the shots. It seems like North Carolina might have that this year, which is an incredible boon to where they could go as a team. But like I said, I'm optimistic, but I'm not going to conclude anything. It's going to be interesting to see them develop throughout the year in this regard.
So that's the number one team in the country, North Carolina. Number two is Kentucky, and they are also 2-0 at this point. And yes. Scal Labissiere got 26 points in his second game. You wrote a blog post about him that can be found right now at CBSSports.com. Mm-hmm. What'd you see?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first game, he kind of sleepwalked a little bit through it in the first half. And then, like, I don't know if you remember this, there was a little bit of a dust up with Alex Poitras and a guy on who was their Albany, I think was their first mm-hmm. opponent. There was like a little bit of dust up, and Poitras ended up like shoving a guy. And it seemed like that kind of clicked like Scal into the game a little bit. He scored 9 points in the second half. And then in the game against NJIT, he was a monster. He scored 26 points, went like 10 of 12 from the field. But you know, the stuff that you were told about Scal Labissiere that I've written about, back when I saw him at Hoop Summit, that I'm sure you've written about in the past, because you've probably written more words than anyone on Scal Labissiere at this point.
I think that's true.
The stuff that you saw in high school, it's there. The incredible fluid athleticism, the mid-range jumper. He was knocking down crazy like turnarounds that with this ridiculously high elevation, ridiculously high release point that's going to make his shot incredibly hard to block. So like, even though he's not strong enough to gain any sort of post position, even against Albany and NJIT, like they were holding him out to like the 13-foot range typically, he was still scoring at will. I mean, it's just going to be a matter of him getting stronger and him continuing to develop his body. But, you know, the whole package is there. Like, he's going to be a beast this year, and I'm really excited to see him play Duke because, you know, Duke has a few defenders, but particularly Emile Jefferson is a guy that could cause him problems to me. Emile's a really smart defender, strong guy for his size. He's put on a lot of weight in his 4 years at Duke. He's mobile, but he's also very long. So I think that that's the kind of guy that I want to see Labissiere go up against, and I hope it happens more often on Tuesday.
I'm glad you mentioned Duke because they are also 2-0, and I'm going to the Champions Classic in Chicago. I'm actually flying there later on today, and I can't wait. It is always a terrific event, and in fact, I've got a column coming to CBSSports.com just sort of detailing like my basic premise, and don't steal this if you're another writer out there. My basic premise is that tomorrow night in Chicago is going to be awesome because it is always awesome. If you go back and look at the history of the Champions Classic, like there is a really awesome storyline basically every single year. Like in the first year, 2011, that was the game where Mike Krzyzewski became the winningest coach in men's Division I basketball history. And it was a first look on a national stage at Anthony Davis and the eventual national champion Kentucky Wildcats. In 2012, Kentucky lost, even though they were ranked preseason number one. And it was sort of a glimpse into you know, oh wow, this might not go as well as any of us thought, and that was ended up being the Kentucky NIT team. 2013 game, you had the 1-2 matchup between Kentucky and Michigan State. You had six McDonald's All-Americans on that Kentucky team, and then you also got the Andrew Wiggins Jabari Parker matchup. And then last year, you had the future national champion Duke involved. Okafor was awesome. Kentucky beat the brains out of Kansas, which was a sign of what they were going to do to a lot of people all year long. So there is something that happens at the Champions Classic every year that gives you a glimpse to what's going to be a huge storyline, you know, throughout the rest of the year for college basketball. So I'm looking forward to getting to the United Center. But not only to see Scow and to see, you know, a Kansas team that's ranked in the top five in the country, and not only to see a Michigan State team that, you know, lost some pieces, but is still a consensus top 15 team, but to see Grayson Allen, my God, what is going on with Grayson Allen?
Yeah, he was the CBS Sports Player of the Week this week. That should be posted by the time that this podcast gets released. Yeah, he's incredibly fun. We kind of saw a glimpse of it last year in the national title game, didn't we? He's relentless. He's just going to attack, 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 attack. And the thing with him that's different a little bit this year is the book on him coming out of high school was, you know, the jump shot is coming along, but it's not quite there yet. The jump shot looked there this weekend. I mean, he scored 27 points a game, 4 rebounds, 4 assists, and he knocked down 5 three-pointers, made like 95% of his 19 free throw attempts. Like, if he's going to shoot like that and be that kind of athlete, the ceiling for that Duke team goes up a whole nother level to me, because I was a little bit worried about, you know, how they would score and how they would get in and out of their offensive sets. But if Grayson Allen's just going to be able to create offense at will like that, yeah, I have no idea what to expect with them.
He obviously had a breakout in the national championship game, which for people like us who you know, follow the sport, you know, basically 365 days a year, like we recognize that, okay, that this was crazy what he was doing, but like he's a super talented kid. But from the casual sports fan, it was like, oh, Duke brought a little white dude off the bench and he's balling out. Like it's important to remember he was
Grayson Allen.
He was a 5-star recruit, you know, like
he's a McDonald's All-American.
Yeah. Like he's just because he's a little white dude, this ain't like Spike coming off the bench for Michigan in the championship game. Right. I mean, this is with all due respect to Spike, who I love, but, no, Grayson Allen is talented, but still, like, I didn't expect this. I mean, through the opening weekend of college basketball, in terms of players on marquee teams, like, he was probably, I guess, more impressive than anybody else out there.
Yeah, I mean, there's one guy that we'll get to probably in a minute whenever you ask me what else I saw around the country that I would point to. But Allen was ridiculous. I mean, the whole story of him just looking like Ted Cruz and being able to come off the bench and just out of nowhere and just being this ridiculous athlete who can slam all over everyone is awesome. He's going to be such a fun kid to watch this year. Even though he's like the prototypical Dookie, just at him. He looks like a senator. But then he doesn't play like the prototypical Dookie. He's trying to dunk on you. Like, that's what's going to be so different about him. He is the first guy at Duke, like, since maybe Dante Jones, where I just look at him and I'm just like, this guy is going to try and throw down on you every time. He's only 6'4", but it doesn't matter.
No, he's going to turn into one of the, frankly, stars of college basketball because, I mean, let's just be honest with each other. He plays at Duke. That's a good place to start. But also, white kid who looks like a senator. You know, sometimes these other things matter. Like, I think Jimmer being named Jimmer helped. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm being serious. Like, if Jimmer were named Jeff, Jeff Fredette, it wouldn't have been the same thing as Jimmer. Like, having the name Jimmer matters. Adam Morris's mustache, I think that mattered. Being a white kid at Duke who, like, will also, like, try to dunk on you like he's something other than a white kid at Duke, like, that's going to resonate with college basketball fans. It just will. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just telling you the truth. And so it'll be interesting to see if – I don't expect he can keep this pace up, but, like – tomorrow night in the United Center, it'll be fun to watch him play on that big stage and have an opportunity to go out and get 25 if he can. You know, typically last year, or not typically, every single game last year, he wasn't given an opportunity because of the other guards they had in that program to go out and show this kind of stuff. But now it's his place and time to an opportunity to show it. So that'll be another fun storyline for the United Center. All right, you asked for it. What else did you stood out from you over the weekend?
Can we just, like, point out that Chris Dunn, like, threw up a stat line that literally hasn't been equaled in at least the last 5 years of college basketball? He threw up 32 points, 6 rebounds, 5 assists, 8 steals, and 2 blocks. Yeah. The closest thing that I could find to that was DJ Cooper, the little guard from Ohio that went to the Sweet 16 a few years ago. He did something like that. He did something like 30 points, 10 assists, I think something like, you know, 6 rebounds and like 8 steals, but didn't have the blocks with it. Like, Chris Dunn dominated Harvard in a way that I did not expect anyone to dominate Harvard, even though, like, they're an Ivy League team. This program has been really, really good for the last, what, 5-6 years. Harvard couldn't stop him in the second half. He went like 7 of 7 for 20 points. He was a freight train in transition. He was pulling, like, he legitimately looked like an NBA player on the floor, just with the way his body is built now. He's a lot stronger. He's a lot, like, wider around the shoulders and thicker. And the way that he was just crossing guys over, the way that he's apparently added a post game to his game. He's added a little bit more jump shooting consistency, it looks like, in his release. Just everything that made Chris Dunn a potential top 10 pick last year before he tried to return, it looks like he's built upon that and just, he's going to destroy worlds this year.
In the preseason, we talked so much about Chris Dunn, specifically about how we came to the conclusion that we just were going to go with Kyle Wiltshire for preseason National Player of the Year as opposed to Chris Dunn. And I still think that was all rooted in sound stuff. I mean, we know that Wiltshire is going to be terrific on a terrific team. And we knew that Chris Dunn would be terrific, but we weren't sure his team would be good enough to really put him in a position to be a National Player of the Year. Just one game, so we'll see. But I'm starting to feel like he's just going to be so independently awesome that it might be a situation where we go, all right, he's on a borderline NCAA tournament team, but my God, the kid's just too good. Like, his numbers are just too off the charts, and possibly, like, record setting in the modern era of college basketball. Like, he might just be that statistical monster that you cannot ignore.
Yeah, like an Evan Turner, for instance, at Ohio State. I think that they were a 2 seed even his second year, but, like, he went like 25-5 that year that he won National Player of the Year. And I think that only Nate Walters and AJ English last year have done that, like, in the last 15 years. So, like, if Chris Dunn did something like that, it wouldn't be out of the question at all to me.
Meanwhile, another talented point guard, season already over, EC Matthews at Rhode Island, torn ACL about 10 minutes into their season opener. Just just awful. Like, you don't wish that on anybody. I mean, even like rival Atlantic 10 fans are just like, you know, you don't like seeing, even if it might make your path to something a little simpler. You don't wish that on anybody. I mean, this is a kid who, you know, has pro aspirations and has pro ability to some degree. And yet, 10 minutes into the season, you couldn't wait for, and it's already over. Does that put an end to Rhode Island's, chances of an NCAA tournament? On paper with EC Matthews, they look like a tournament team. Without him, I don't know.
I would say it doesn't put an end to it necessarily. It certainly puts them behind the eight ball, and they were my favorites to win the Atlantic 10 before the year with him involved. But they have a couple of transfers in Fore McGlynn from Towson and Curran Iverson, who you're obviously pretty familiar with, who they give this team a little bit more of a depth than they had last year and a little bit more of an explosive ability than they had last year on offense. If Danny Hurley can get those guys moving defensively as well, because that's the other thing about EC Matthews, he's a really good defensive player. You can always trust him to kind of make the right reads and make the right rotations and also shut down a guy. So if you can get those guys involved defensively as well as offensively, and you can get Hassan Martin to be really, really good, I don't think it's over for them necessarily. Like I said, I trust Hurley a lot. Like, I think he's an incredible coach. I think that he'll get these guys going. But like I said, it really puts them behind the eight ball. Dayton will, we assume, get Tyshawn Pierre back. That'll be a problem. Davidson's still Davidson with Bob McKillop, and that's going to be a really tough out for A-10 teams. But I wouldn't put them out yet. What do you think?
No, I mean, I wouldn't put them out yet, if only because it's November 16th, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, you could have put Dayton out last year, you know, after they had to remove two bigs from the program, and you would have looked silly for doing that. So let's let it play out. But obviously, it's a huge blow. I mean, it's a massive, massive loss that is, if they can overcome it, hats off to Dan Hurley, because it'll be a hell of a coaching job. But yeah, let's let it play out. I'm not interested in burying anybody on November 16th, except for maybe Virginia Tech.
Yeah, I think we can bury Buzz's team on that one. Also good news for Rhode Island, Jarvis Garrett, another guard who went down with an injury. He might miss a little bit of time, but he's not going to be out for the year like EC Matthews. So that was a little bit of good news in the trench of what was a disaster for Rhode Island in their opening game, even though they ended up beating American pretty soundly.
All right, before we get out of here, it is the 24 hours of college basketball is basically on tap. I think it starts, does it start like late Monday night, actually? Like, is that the way this thing works?
Yeah, it starts late tonight. I know that Baylor, Oregon is like at 11:30, and then BYU, Long Beach State's at like at 11:30 Eastern time, or no, maybe 1:30 Eastern time it is. So yeah, I think it starts a little bit later tonight, and then we'll get into all those goofy early morning games that, now being on the West Coast, that I miss. I think the best one of those is actually Rhode Island playing in it. They play Valparaiso. That'll be an interesting game because both those teams have NCAA tournament aspirations. Valparaiso looked awesome this weekend against Iona,
right,
which is another like top 10 mid-major program. So Rhode Island's going to get a test there against Valpo. I'm trying to think of some other games.
Well, you get Champions Classic, obviously. You get Memphis, Oklahoma. That's tomorrow at 5 Eastern on ESPN. So, you know, a big opportunity, as we talked about last week, for Josh Pastner to try to get enthusiasm back into the program. To underline that, like, Memphis opened the season on Saturday night against Southern Miss. I believe about 4,000 people were at FedEx Forum. Now, some of that was because the Tiger football team was also playing on television. So, like, a lot of folks, I'm assuming, just decided to stay home and watch. But still, yeah. To go from, you know, just a couple of years ago, 18,000 in there basically for any game, and now 4,000 for your season opener, it underlines and highlights the relative lack of enthusiasm for Memphis basketball right now. But if you could beat a top 10 team at home, you can get a lot of that back. And then obviously you get the Champions Classic. That is Kentucky versus Duke, followed by Kansas versus Michigan State. So the better of the two games, both great games, but the better of the two games, probably the undercard game, Kentucky-Duke. Then, of course, you get Georgetown-Maryland, which is massive in that part of the country. I mean, it's two national brands, but massive in that part of the country because it's Georgetown-Maryland. It's it's you know, they're separated by what, probably about 30 minutes, but 25 mm-hmm. minutes, and they haven't played in forever. So, or they haven't scheduled regular season games in forever. So that'll be a big matchup. And then the other one that I think sneaky good, Wichita State at Tulsa.
Yeah, that's a pretty good game. Tulsa's a borderline contender in the American. They should certainly be contending for an NCAA tournament bid this year, and that's at Tulsa. So, you know, I could see a circumstance where Wichita goes there and doesn't come away with a win. So that should be a fun one, yeah.
And then, of course, the other ones involved, you get Nebraska-Villanova. I don't know if Nebraska is equipped to go play that game. Notre Dame gets Milwaukee, and then Connecticut against, I guess it's New Hampshire. Those are the top 20 games involving top 25 teams.
Well, Wisconsin's also in there too. Should we also just note what happened to Wisconsin this weekend?
What a boy. I think we all knew they were going to miss Frank Kaminsky and Sam Decker. I don't know that we thought they were going to miss those guys as well as some others as badly as they seem to have missed them in the opening weekend.
Yeah, if you missed it, Wisconsin lost to Western Illinois. Yeah, that sounds ridiculous on the surface, but it's probably even worse whenever you take into account that in the preseason poll of the Summit League, where, you know, they get coaches, SIDs, media to vote on the standings for the league preseason-wise, Western Illinois was last in the Summit League coming into the year. And that's the team that just beat Wisconsin. Like you said, Sam Decker, Frank Kaminsky, but honestly, those other guys that you didn't mention, those are the guys that stood out to me being gone. You know, they'd bring in Ethan Happ, Vito Brown, Zach Showalter. Those guys are, you know, maybe they'll be there by the end of the year, but, you know, having to replace guys like Duye Dukin, who's somehow on an NBA roster right now, Trey Jackson, Josh Gosser, like all of that group, I think is the harder, it's not the harder part to, replace, but it's the part that they probably didn't anticipate having to replace. And there's a difference between throwing in these four older seniors and throwing in guys that have never played before, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bo has been one of the, it's for sure, he's been one of the most consistently consistent winners in college basketball. They never really slip. And yet, I wonder how many times, I don't think it's been often, he's had to replace this much. Not just two, the first round draft picks, but like other pieces. And, you know, Duke can lose this type of talent off of one team because they're Duke and they they'll go sign a top two recruiting class and be fine. Same thing at Kentucky. But like a Wisconsin, it's not really the type of place that is stocked with young talent to be able to endure all of the losses that they're having to endure.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, they have some young guys there that might be interesting. Khalil Iverson is a kid from Ohio that's pretty good. Brevin Pritzel played a little bit. They have another big guy with a strange name that I don't know how to pronounce yet. They're freshmen and they might be able to come around eventually. Plus, like I said, Ethan Happ was a guy that they were pretty excited about coming into the year. Zach Showalter played a little bit in the national title game. Vito Brown, same thing. And maybe these guys will come along, but it's right now it's kind of a struggle. It's hard to imagine them continuing the top four streak that Bo Ryan has in the Big Ten.
It looks that way right now. All right, let's get out of here. Remember, you can subscribe to the Ion College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. It's the quickest way to get your hands on the latest episode, so make sure to do that. And either way, I suppose we will talk again on Wednesday. Like I said, I'm headed to Chicago for the Champions Classic. I'll be there Tuesday night. I'll be traveling Wednesday, so the timing might be a little, I don't know. We'll figure it out. But we will talk again post-Champions Classic before the weekend. Till then, take care. And good luck, Matt Norlander, if you're listening, on having that first child.